dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Nobody covers that war from an investigative journalism point of view than our first guest. He is Bill Gertz, a regular here, I'm pleased to say, a man who writes the prize-winning Inside the Ring column at the Washington Times and is senior editor of an indispensable online resource, the Washington Free Beacon. He's also the author of some 7 best-selling books, including most recently I, War, War and Peace in the Information Age, and a new book forthcoming this fall about China. And China is, of course, a topic that we talk about with Bill often. It's good to have you back, Bill. Welcome.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
Well, I want to get to China in a minute, Bill. But first off, your Inside the Ring column has some very important insights into why it was necessary for President Trump to order the Director of National Intelligence to declassify information that would be material to the effort by Attorney General Bill Barr to get to the bottom of what the investigators in the anti-Trump collusion conspiracy were doing. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is an important story. It basically points out that one of the reasons that the president granted special intelligence authority, that is to declassify and make public, according to security guidelines, important intelligence as part of the review of the counterintelligence probe known as Crossfire Hurricane, which was the FBI's effort to spy on the Trump campaign and essentially the president. And it really shows that, according to officials that I talked to, that the president does not trust Daniel Coates, the director of national intelligence, to be honest and fair in that assessment. So he delegated that authority. So instead of giving his top intelligence advisor the authority, he gave the attorney general that authority. And sources tell me that one of the reasons was that the White House was very upset by testimony in February from Coates at the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing, where he basically undermined the efforts to negotiate a nuclear deal with North Korea by stating in response to questions from Democrats that he didn't think that or that it was the intelligence community's assessment that North Korea will not give up its nuclear weapons and will seek to maintain them. And the reason they were upset was, as they said, well, that may be accurate, making it public at that time really undercut the efforts. And of course, 2 months after that testimony in March, the president met in Hanoi with Kim Jong-un and for what was eventually a failed summit. So again, this memorandum was designed to send an unmistakable signal. Now, people tell me they don't think that Coates is going to be fired by the president, although with this president, you can't be sure about anything like that. He fired his Secretary of State on Twitter last couple of years ago. So that's kind of where it stands.
Well, this is a hugely important development, no question about it. And it's going to, I think, enable this investigation to get to the bottom of what's been going on, assuming, and this is a big caveat, Bill, assuming that the so-called deep state doesn't do what, well, John Brennan and Jim Clapper, the former director of national intelligence, are importuning them to do, which is to simply defy the president's direction. What do you think is likely to happen there?
Well, clearly, within the U.S. government, there are two bureaucracies which are the most, I would say, anti-Republican. In other words, they never oppose or leak against Democratic administrations, but as soon as a Republican is in office, you see leaks coming out. And that's the Foreign Service, which is in the State Department, and the intelligence bureaucracy. And of course, we heard a lot from the former intelligence officials and their allies in the liberal press decrying this new memorandum from Barr on declassification authority as saying that this was somehow undermine sources and methods of intelligence. But yet we heard no similar complaints when the intelligence community in 2017 released some horrible, damaging intelligence leaks, which have never been tracked down, that were designed to smear the incoming President Trump.
Yeah. The swamp at work and the need for draining it has been never more urgent, it seems to me, Bill. So thank you for keeping an eye on this. One of the other things you're keeping an eye on, of course, is what China is up to. And in particular, you had in the Washington Free Beacon today a very important story. Tell us, Bill Gertz, what we are now being advised is the state of the Chinese nuclear arsenal, according to the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, Lieutenant General Robert Ashley.
Yes, General Ashley made an important speech this week in which he talked about the Chinese nuclear arsenal. And it was unusual in the sense that this was really kind of declassifying some new intelligence information regarding the massive buildup of nuclear forces by the Chinese, which includes an array of new weapons, mainly missiles, but also a new bomber and new submarine missiles, which are clearly designed to target the United States. And he revealed that the Chinese plan over the next decade to double their nuclear arsenal. And he said that he didn't release the exact figures, but he said the current arsenal, which again is a very vague estimate, is what he called the low couple of hundreds of warheads, which again has been in dispute. The number could be as many as 1,000. Because of Chinese secrecy, we really don't know. China has a massive underground nuclear complex that's been known as the Great Underground Wall, 3,000 miles of tunnels, which are used not only to store nuclear weapons, but also to develop them. In other words, they have entire factories underground.
Yeah, and develop and produce, more to the point. So we really don't have a clue what they've actually got in their arsenal, I would guess.
Right. And speaking of underground facilities, General Ashley also revealed that the Russians, for the first time, he revealed that the Russians are developing an earth-penetrating nuclear warhead, similar to the Arnhem warhead that the U.S. abandoned in 2005 under pressure from anti-nuclear activists. And this shows that we really need something that can penetrate. Of all of our nuclear weapons, we only have one weapon, the B-61, which has some penetrating capability, but all of our adversaries are going deep underground with their facilities, and unless we develop something like that, we're going to be really undermining our ability to do serious strategic nuclear deterrence.
Right. This is such an important point. We'll be talking more about it shortly with Michaela Dodge. Keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us again next week, if you would. I hope you'll stay well in the meantime. Next up, Todd Bensman from the Center for Immigration Studies on threats to our border from illegal immigrants and Hezbollah. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Todd Bensman is a national treasure by my lights. He works for a terrific organization, the Center for Immigration Studies, as its national security fellow based in Texas, where he has spent much of his life working both in government and out as an investigative journalist in the latter capacity and as an investigator with sort of intelligence teams, notably with the Department of Public Safety of Texas, working border insecurity and what flows from it in terms of the interior of the United States. These days, he is a very active contributor to the public policy debate at places like The Federalist and, of course, on the CIS website, cis.org. And we welcome you back. It's so good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Well, I've got a lot to talk to you about, so let's move through this briskly. You've written a piece that is very much, I think, to the point about what's animating or at least certainly exacerbating the border security crisis of the moment with, by some accounts, a 1,000-person sort of caravan-type insertions of illegal aliens per day now, many of them accompanied by minors. And you've called this the faux family scam. Tell us what that's about and why it's working at the moment.
Spread a few months back, Latin America, and particularly the Northern Triangle countries, that if you have a kid with you when you cross the U.S. border, you can pretty much skip any sort of lengthy detention and be released into the interior of the U.S. with legal authorization to be here.
Whether that's your kid or somebody else's, though, right?
That's right. So obviously this has placed a higher value on children because now, single men or people who don't have children need to get one quick to be able to take advantage of this loophole. It's a loophole in the asylum system, you know, the Flores Agreement that limits the amount of time that we can hold family units in detention. It's about 20 days, but we're not even doing that anymore because there's so many coming that we just let them out almost immediately, maybe in a day or 2 days, and you're out into the countryside. So what's happened is mothers and fathers of more than one kid are renting them out to people who don't have kids to get a reduction on their smuggling fee, or sometimes it's, if it's not in kind, it's cash. And the scam is to often travel with the child to the border, give the kid up to whoever is paying, and then hopefully reunite on the other side inside the United States. And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't work, but the kid's at risk at that point.
So these are not necessarily people who are coming across the unguarded and generally more dangerous sections of the border. These are people who are just coming up to a border patrol, crossing point and turning themselves in with this kid and asking for asylum. Is that how this works?
Yeah, I mean, the scam only works when you turn yourself in and exploit the asylum law claim. You just want to get a claim going. Whether or not you ever actually see it through is beside the point. You just need to get it going. And then you get your paperwork and you're released. And then, hopefully you'll find the mother or a relative on this side and deliver the child.
Yeah. But more likely, is it not, you'll turn them into trafficked children because there must be money in that, isn't there?
Well, in my conversations with Homeland Security Investigations, which is the investigative arm of ICE, there are a number of variations of this scam. It's right now is mostly regarded as alien smuggling rather than trafficking. Trafficking implies, kind of some sort of prostitution related thing. Not that that's not happening, but probably less so than just regular smuggling. Just sort of get the kid in and get yourself in.
But I think the trouble here is, of course, there's a climate of illegality that is being encouraged, enabled, rewarded. And this can only translate into more people doing more of this kind of thing to children and coming here illegally, of course.
There's an indication that this is happening on a mass scale. ICE did a pilot DNA testing program at a few select places and found that 30% of all of the families that were coming over were unrelated to each other biologically. Right. That indicates that if there is significant enough deterrence and prosecution, that this entire wave of migration could be shut down just from that.
Well, in a sort of a desperate bid to try to get a grip on this, in the absence of Congress helping with increasing the number of judges or Border Patrol or otherwise seeking to stem effectively this tide, notably by building a wall, The president has announced that he intends in June to start imposing sanctions on a sort of escalating basis on Mexican goods if they don't cooperate more fully in stemming this tide of illegal aliens coming across our border. Give us your quick take on that, as you see it from Texas, particularly Todd Benjamin.
Yeah, well, the Trump administration has repeatedly expressed its frustration with the Mexican government for not more forcibly and forcefully halting that migration at their border with Guatemala. Typically, the Mexicans will yield, their police forces and military will yield to the caravans coming through and will be providing humanitarian visas and basically paving the way, greasing the skids for large numbers of these people to make it to the U.S. border. It's expensive and problematic for the Mexicans to keep them. I understand that. Everybody understands. Nobody wants to be stuck with the hot potato. So the Trump administration's putting the vise down, tightening the vise on the Mexicans to be more inclined, I guess, to stop that traffic flow.
And incentivizing them and securing their own southern border. They've got pretty draconian laws on the books, the Mexicans do, about illegal immigration in their country. And enforcing that would go a long way towards, I think, solving our problem as well.
Yeah, one thing is stop granting the humanitarian visas en masse like they are.
Yeah, absolutely. Todd, there's an interesting initiative that's underway at the moment called We Build the Wall. And it's private citizens, privately funded on private property, trying to do something to secure the border in a way that again, Congress is not allowing the president to do more broadly. What can you tell us about that initiative? And does it hold promise for making a difference, do you think?
That effort is, I think, in my opinion, it's a little bit too it's symbolic and interesting and laudable in its own way, but I think it's too episodic in its implementation to really do any good, because what you'll end up with is like segments of wall, you know, relatively short segments of wall on, you know, ranch lands with the hope that the federal government will come in and fill in the blanks, you know, the bigger blanks. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's a sort of form of protest.
A demonstration of popular sentiment, at least, I guess, but symbolic to be sure. So let me turn to one other thing that you've addressed recently, Todd, and that is the problem of terrorism in all of this. Specifically, you were moved to write about John Walker Lind and the fact that he and, unfortunately, quite a number of others who have been convicted of terrorism, or I would add, perhaps came to jihad while in American prisons, are going to be set loose on the American people. You have some thoughts as to how to prevent them from being a threat. What would you recommend in that regard?
Most terrorists who have been convicted on terrorism-related charges in the United States got terms of less than 10 years. So, you know, do the math, we're 7 to 8 years out of 9/11, and they're being released. Lots of convicted terrorists are being released. The problem is that the U.S. government, the Bureau of Prisons, Department of Justice, nobody keeps track whatsoever of how many of these folks are recommitting, reengaging in the fight, and that creates the risk of undetermined proportion for which we don't know what's happening. Nobody's tracking it. That's a problem right there. Maybe it's not much of a risk or a threat. But on the other hand, we also have evidence that terrorists who are released from Guantanamo Bay, Gitmo, have reengaged to the tune of about 30%. They go right back to the field and they're killing. So we have this sort of indication that there is a threat. We have had some terrorists, convicts, reengage and end up back in prison.
Yeah. Well, and it's particularly unnerving that this fellow, the so-called American Taliban, was let out for good behavior early, even though some of his behavior exhibited a continuing commitment to violent jihad as recently, I believe, as 2016. This has given rise on our part at the Center for Security Policy to a recommendation that at the state level, or certainly ideally at the federal level, we have a terrorist registry whereby law enforcement could be advised and kept apprised of whether these terrorists are locating in their communities. Because if, as you say, Todd Bensman, there is recidivism, we better make sure that they're all over it. Todd, lastly, you have been warning for some time, based on your firsthand experience with Latin America, about the presence there of other terrorists, notably Iranian-backed Hezbollah. Tell us whether the Iranian regime has figured out a way to offset some of the diminished resources they have to give to Hezbollah through drug trafficking and other techniques in our own, well, I call it front yard.
Yeah, well, this was prompted by the reporting in the New York Times and the Washington Post that Hezbollah is having a cash crunch right now. They're broke, having to cut salaries and do that sort of thing, almost as though the newspapers are trying to indicate that the Hezbollah terrorist group is not really a threat right now with all the saber rattling. Don't worry about Hezbollah. But the fact of the matter is that Hezbollah makes tons and tons of money with cocaine trafficking increasingly throughout Latin America.
Todd Bensman, thank you so much for visiting with us and for the tremendously important work you and your colleagues do at the Center for Immigration Studies. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Harold Road is up next, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's a pleasure to say we are joined by an old friend and very highly regarded colleague. His name is Dr. Harold Road. He served for many years as one of the senior, well, go-to resources in the Department of Defense for his expertise on matters involving the Middle East, especially Iran and Turkey, but more generally as well. He is a very valued resource for us here at Secure Freedom Radio, as he is to the audience that he addresses with some regularity at the Gatestone Institute, where he is a senior fellow. He is the author, among other things, of Modern Islamic Warfare, An Ancient Doctrine Marches On. Harold Road, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Frank, nice to be here.
Harold, so much to talk with you about. I guess I'd start with Iran. This is a country you know well. You've spent time in. You have studied closely. You have, I think, perhaps an unparalleled appreciation for what actually makes the mullahs tick, and specifically what they might be up to at the moment with respect to the, well, what I hope might be the death throes of their regime and what could flow from that perception on their part. Talk us through what's going on in Tehran and elsewhere in Iran at the moment and what it might mean for the region and for us.
Well, from the mullah's point of view, the greatest aspect of the Iranian revolution is pushing America out, keeping America at bay. Now, all over Iran, there is an interest in getting rid of the mullahs, the riots every day. They're not covered for some reason in the Western press. I think that because it probably doesn't fit the narrative that the liberal media wants to portray. But it's terrible unrest, and that allows the regime to repress people because nobody in the West seems to care. Having said that, why is it happening, and how are the people, why is it that the people are losing their fear of going against the mullahs? They believe, finally, that the regime is, as you said, in its death throes, because America is standing up with the people of Iran against the tyrants that have ruled them. Most of the people want us to be left alone. They don't want to be involved in foreign conflicts. And when they travel, they want to be the respected people that they were before the revolution 41 years or so ago. And they want to join the international community. They love America by and large. And the Trump administration has been doing a very good job of trying to encourage the people to revolt against their tyrants, the regime that rules them. Only one problem, though. When rumors get out that President Trump is willing to negotiate with the regime, it, in essence, it's a signal to the Iranian people that, the American government wants the regime to stay in power. So the people at times get confused and don't know what to do about it. Now, from an American point of view, you can understand President Trump doesn't want to send soldiers anywhere. They would like a peaceful change in government there. And but it is confusing to the Iranian people. And President Trump claims that he is not willing to negotiate except if the Iranian government is prepared to accept the terms under which President Trump is prepared to negotiate, which means ending the nuclear program in Iran and ending foreign intervention in Iran's neighbors.
Yeah. Harold, let me just ask you on this point, because this is really the crux of the matter, obviously. As long as this regime is in power with its mantra of death to America, is there any realistic prospect, in your really informed professional judgment, that there would actually be an end to their nuclear ambitions and their weapons program that has been beavering away on it all these years? And their capacity to hide things from us underground and otherwise is pretty well documented, though we don't know the full magnitude of it. So again, this seems to me to be a very, very important caveat on the idea that we'd be delighted to, you know, continue to have this regime in power as long as it stopped being the regime that it is, I guess is what it comes down to.
Frank, the equivalent would be you have children. If me offering you, let's say, a deal, and that is you can get whatever you want in this world, all you have to do is give up your children forever. But you're not going to do that. And that's what the deal, it's actually quite sophisticated, that Trump seems to be offering the Iranians. Look, you give up on your nuclear program, you give up on your and interfering in your neighbor's affairs, and then we can talk. And the whole reason for existence, the greatness, again, of the regime, is that it has gotten America out of Iranian affairs. That's how they see it. It's impossible for the regime to accept this. Its raison d'etre is to take over the Muslim and the entire Muslim world and make the entire Muslim world Shiite, which is why the Arab world, which is with the exception of Iraq, ruled by Sunnis. And the rest of the Muslim world doesn't like Iran.
Right. And it's not just that they don't like them. They feel very threatened by them, hence an effort by the Saudis and others to forge a common position against them. Harold, in this regard, let me just ask you a question, turning to sort of inside baseball. There is unmistakably a push underway, I think egged on by foreign adversaries, but also supported by some in this country. I think it's fair to say some who may have aspirations to benefit from the outcome that they're pursuing, namely the removal of John Bolton as President Trump's national security advisor. And I personally think this would be a horrible idea, but I imagine that the Iranians, and for that matter, some of the other people you've mentioned, the North Koreans, the Chinese, the Russians, there would be considerable enthusiasm for such an outcome. How would it be seen, for example, from Tehran?
A huge victory for the regime.
Huge victory.
Huge victory for the regime. Now, both the Iranians and the Chinese have something in common. They work indirectly behind the scenes. They use their culture to entice people. And in this particular instance, John Bolton believes that, you know, you've got to stand up against the people who are against America. And even as nice as the Iranians try to be and the Chinese try to be, because it's really a variant of the same, John Bolton is under no illusions. And they, therefore, want John Bolton gone. I think it would be a disaster for the United States if we lose John Bolton. He's one of the greatest Americans that I know in government.
I do too. And I think he's been doing an outstanding job supporting President Trump in implementing the policy of peace through strength that he campaigned on and that he has made his national security strategy. Hey, Harold, let me switch gears one more time. You spend a fair amount of your time in the Holy Land, in the state of Israel. I wondered if you could possibly explain to us what on earth is going on with the government of the state of Israel, one of our most important allies, certainly in the Middle East and arguably elsewhere as well. We know that Bibi Netanyahu is going to have to go back to the drawing boards on a new electoral campaign. But why did this come about, and what do you think is likely to come of it?
Well, Avigdor Lieberman, who is the he's head of a party called Israel, Our Homeland, which is basically for older former Soviets, he hates Netanyahu with a passion. Why is a history. It's not really, it's today, it's really not important. And from the very beginning, means after the Israeli elections, it was clear that Lieberman in no way was prepared to compromise, to become part of the government. And the result was, because his hatred of Netanyahu seems to me the paramount. Now, the result is that the way the Israeli government, unfortunately, with this crazy electoral system that it has, you need, of the 120 members of the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, you need 61 members, meaning one more than half, to form a government. And the way, again, the crazy electoral system that Israel has, the way it worked, without Lieberman, it couldn't be done. Now, the argument was supposedly with the ultra-Orthodox, who have something like 15, 16 seats. I don't remember the exact number. And because there's a question of the ultra-Orthodox men serving in the Israeli military. And more, it's a long history of why they have been allowed to study in their yeshivas and their religious institutions and not go into the military. But that is all changing, and it's going in the direction where more and more are serving in the military. And the ultra-Orthodox parties have been extremely flexible and definitely prepared to come compromise. And Lieberman, who was the one who was pushing this, I would call it anti-religious line in the negotiations. It's like, I want my way 100%. I compromise on absolutely nothing. And the religious have been very prepared to compromise. But Lieberman's idea or his goal was to bring down Netanyahu. We have Nathan Hale in our history. I regret when the British are ready to kill him. His last words, I regret. I have only one life to give for my country. I think I would describe Lieberman as, I regret. I only have one country to give for my life. That's the basis politically of all. It's sad. It's terrible. And let's hope that the next round of elections, that is on September 17th, will change things.
Change things by keeping things as they are, I guess you mean, the re-election of Bibi Netanyahu.
Netanyahu has done more for the state of Israel and for the American alliance than anybody, really. There's only one other Israeli prime minister who can compare with, and that's David Ben-Gurion, who was the first prime minister of Israel.
Harold, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. Thank you so much for your time today. It's always a delight to catch up with you. We'll be doing so again, I hope, in the very near future. We'll talk with you soon.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's a delight to say we're joined by a dear friend and colleague of many years, Michaela Dodge. She is a senior policy analyst in the Heritage Foundation's Davis Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy, where she works on defense and strategic policy. She's had a number of other positions, including as a Publius Fellow, a much admired position, as far as I'm concerned, at the Claremont Institute, and also as the National Security Assistant for Senator John Kyle, when he returned to public service briefly, all too briefly, as far as I'm concerned, last year. And it's great to have her with us. Thank you so much, Michaela, for all that you do to sort of raise awareness about and explicate what's going on in the defense and particularly strategic forces and nuclear deterrence portfolios.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be back.
Good. Thank you. So, Michaela, where to begin? I guess I was really struck by an official statement by the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, Lieutenant General Robert Ashley, to the effect that we are now willing to say publicly what I think you and I and others have been saying for some time privately, that is, the Russians are engaged in low-yield nuclear testing. Tell us, first of all, what the evidence of that is, as you see it, and the implications.
Lieutenant General Ashley made comments that Russia is conducting activities that indicate that Russia doesn't share U.S. interpretation of the CTBT, which is zero yield, which means that any nuclear experiments that we do cannot produce yield of any kind, however little. Now, I think the little more maybe interesting part of his comments were that Russians can use potentially these activities to improve their nuclear warheads. And, you know, that's of great concern because we do not conduct similar activities. We do not improve our nuclear warheads. And in fact, we have not built a nuclear warhead. We have not fielded a new design in almost 30 years. And so, you know, I think it comes as no surprise that Russia does not share U.S. interpretation of CTBT. There have been quite a few authoritative sources saying that Russia is conducting hydrodynamic experiments, including a reference in the Schlesinger Perry Strategic Buster Commission report from 2009, including the NRC report on CTBT from 2012. But that admission that Russia is potentially improving its warheads, that should give us a pause and that should focus us on trying to understand better what it is that Russia can do potentially using these low-yield experiments and how we handle it in terms of our own nuclear infrastructure capabilities.
Yeah, there's so much to talk about in all of those areas. Let's just briefly do this. We are now looking at a wholesale modernization of the Russian nuclear forces posture, and that has meant new weapons, as well as new delivery systems, of course, and a huge number of them, it seems, and potentially new capabilities. Vice Admiral Robert Monroe, who previously ran, as you know, the Defense Nuclear Agency, has warned that we don't even necessarily understand the kinds of new capabilities that some of these Russian warheads may have. Does that worry you, Michaela Dodge, as a serious practitioner in this space? And if it's the case that the Russians are sort of stealing a very significant technological march on us, having not modernized our nuclear deterrent to speak of, how important is it that we begin taking steps to perform the sorts of low-yield testing that they have to ensure we can modernize ours and keep up?
You know, traditionally, technology and innovation has been one of the foremost strengths in terms of defeating the Soviet Union during the Cold War. In the 90s, we assumed that we're going to have a more cooperative relationship with Russia. There's been hopes of that relationship in 2010 and sort of embodied by the Obama administration's reset policy, even though I think the savvy observers of the Russian Federation knew even at the time that Russia is going to be a problem. Now we are openly talking about the return of the great power competition with Russia, and we are foregoing and prohibiting ourselves from exploiting one of our main competitive advantages, again, technology and innovation, in the nuclear field, in a field where the stakes are the highest, because nuclear weapons are the only weapons that can, in such a short time frame, end the life and alter the life in the United States and of U.S. allies. And so that policy in the context of the great power competition, it does not make sense. It does not make sense technologically speaking. And we now know that our sort of judgments about the continued safety, security, and survivability of the U.S. nuclear stockpile, the scientific judgment underpinning that judgment, that sort of very, very educated opinions based on some experiments, but not a full range of experiments we could be doing, that is eroding. And so we will have to address that. We will have to address proficiency of our workforce. There is a stockpile responsiveness program to start sort of designing and prototyping new nuclear warheads without necessarily fielding them. And that's a really great first step. And I hope it's not too little too late. And I hope that we can sustain and increase support for that program.
There is some resistance to that, apparently, inside at least the House Armed Services Committee under Chairman Adam Smith. Is that right?
Sounds about right. Sounds like something Chairman Smith wouldn't like.
Yeah. So let me just ask you about this, Michaela, because what we've been discussing is, of course, the U.S. versus the Russian nuclear deterrent posture. This is something that has been, to some degree, formalized or at least understood within the context of bilateral arms control agreements. As you know, you've followed this very closely for years. The Russians have been cheating on every one of these agreements, including, I believe, the New START treaty. But all of this is sort of overlooking a natty little problem, troublesome as these topics are, as we've just discussed, and that is China. And I've just seen a report coming across the wire that we are now told the Chinese are doubling the number of nuclear warheads that we've credited them with having. I personally believe that's probably still off by a factor of two or so. But talk a little bit about how China fits into all of this and why it's doubly important that we be attending to our nuclear deterrent posture and modernizing it, ensuring its safety and reliability and effectiveness in light of the fact that we have this other contender whom we also have to deter.
So, you know, traditionally we assume that if we can deter the Soviet Union or the Russia, that sort of we will be able to deter China. And we assume that China has very low number of nuclear warheads. Well, if that's not the case, and if our strategic planning does not account for doubling of Russia's nuclear arsenal, then we may have to reevaluate the number of weapons we deploy. We also should be thinking about an option of Russia and China working together against the United States, which then again gives you different number of nuclear weapons that you have to account for and consider in your nuclear planning. You know, of course, you haven't mentioned Russian advantage on tactical nuclear weapon side. But that advantage illustrates very much how the number of weapons matters, which is because Russia, I think you can make the case that because Russia has superiority on tactical nuclear weapons side, it is more belligerent when planning its conventional operations, particularly regional conventional operations.
I think it was Stalin who said, quantity has a quality all its own, and that would certainly apply to nuclear forces. Michaela, we are hard out of time, but there's so much more to talk with you about, including about missile defense, on which you're also expert. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon to discuss that and much, much more. But in the meantime, thank you for the great work you do at the Heritage Foundation these days. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again as well on Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.